If you asked a stadium full of people to close their eyes and imagine what the American dream means to them, a large percentage of the crowd would be thinking of a home. Different homes, no doubt. A ranch house in the suburbs, a 40th floor condominium in Manhattan, a one-bedroom apartment in a new country where the kids will get a shot that the parents never had. A home is rarely just a roof over our heads. It's a roof in a bright city, or a neighborhood near work and family, close to a freeway or train stop, with parks and a stretch of water, maybe a street full of shops and restaurants. A good school, a field to plow, a welcoming church, a Sunday drum circle. Home is a private space, and yet it's the community of work and social life that determines where we want it. It's the dream of being as close as possible to the lives we wish to have. Around the world and country, that dream is under threat. In the United States, the homeownership rate for young adults is at a multi-decade low, and about a quarter of tenant households spend more than half their income on rent. Homelessness is increasing, eviction displaces about 1 million households a year, and about 4 million people spend at least 3 hours commuting to and from work. One need only look out an airplane window to see that this has nothing to do with a lack of space. It's the concentration of opportunity and the rising cost of being near it. It says much about today's winner-take-all economy that many of the cities with the most glaring epidemics of homelessness are growing technology and finance centers where good-paying jobs are plentiful and industries of the future are on the rise. California, home of the nation's worst housing crisis, has the dubious distinction of having somehow managed to produce some of the highest wages in America, as well as the highest state poverty rate once the cost of housing is figured in. This didn't all happen at once. It has become a popular narrative, at least in a certain kind of high-cost city, to say that the reason housing has become so expensive is that working-class neighborhoods are being gentrified, foreign investors are parking money in U.S. condominiums, houses and apartments are being commodified by hedge funds, and companies like Airbnb are turning rental buildings into hotels. These things are all happening, and they've been exacerbated by years of federal disinvestment in affordable housing, a tax code that subsidizes wealthy homeowners at the expense of poor renters, and a building industry that hasn't had any meaningful innovation in decades. But underneath all that is a larger disease, which is a dire shortage of available housing in places where people and companies want to live, along with tectonic changes in how today's technology-centric economy operates. Unlike in the past, when good-paying manufacturing work spread widely across the country and took middle-class wealth beyond cities into small towns, the new economy is more unequal by nature, and its companies tend to cluster around dense metropolitan areas. This has fueled a resurgence in American downtowns and tons of new jobs for people with a wide range of skill levels. But because U.S. cities don't accommodate new people or housing nearly as well or as eagerly as they used to, the growth has caused new residents and speculators to bid up prices of the not enough housing that already exists. For the past several decades, America has by and large solved its housing needs by building progressively cheaper neighborhoods progressively farther out. It has forever changed the landscape and upended our governance as well. In effect, we shattered urban regions into a constellation of smaller cities and reactionary single-family house neighborhoods whose influence over local land use decisions give them an astounding amount of control over how much shelter we build, where, and at what cost. These decisions have huge implications beyond housing. Rising housing costs are a main driver, arguably the main driver, of segregation, income inequality, and racial and generational wealth gaps. You can't talk about educational inequities or the shrinking middle class without talking about how much it costs to live near good schools and high-paying jobs. Transportation accounts for about a third of the nation's carbon dioxide emissions, so there's no serious plan for climate change that doesn't begin with a conversation about how to alter the urban landscape so that people can live closer to work. One way or the other, many of the biggest challenges in America are at some level a housing problem, which is why there is now tremendous pressure on cities to abandon the old pattern of building subdivisions on distant cow pastures and instead to favor taller, denser buildings in places where people already live. The meaning of density varies, from condo towers in the urban core to triplex apartment buildings and backyard cottages in the enclaves of single-family houses beyond. Either way, as cities drive to put more housing in established neighborhoods, the result has been a furious clash over growth, class, preservation, quality of life, and the environment. The story of modern America is the story of a nation struggling to reconcile the way things are today versus the way we think they used to be. Housing is a central narrative here as well, and like so much of contemporary society, that story begins at the end of World War II. In October 1945, a month after the war ended, Life magazine ran a 13-page spread titled "The California Way of Life." The idea was to use California as a window into post-war trends. The state, quote, "may in time radically influence the pattern of life in America as a whole," the magazine wrote. And they did it by profiling three Los Angeles families who made $50,000 a year, $10,000 a year, and $3,000 a year, about $700,000, $140,000, and $42,000, respectively, in 2019 dollars. The rich family, the Stothards, lived in a big house in Santa Monica with a live-in cook and four cars. The middle family, the Campbells, were nearby in a West Los Angeles ranch house with a pool on a three-quarter acre lot. No servants, two cars. The surprise was the third family, which was headed by a fireman named Leroy Loeffler. The Loefflers lived in a six-room bungalow in Glendale that was full of modern appliances and had a backyard patio and lemon tree. The Campbells do not live as differently from the Loefflers as might be supposed from the difference in incomes, Life noted. There's plenty about this picture that we can't or don't want to go back to. All of the families were white. Women's lives are described in terms of shopping trips and social circles. Life made casual mention of the Stothards' quote, "Negro cook," and no mention of the black families across the nation who were being denied access to the federally backed loans that the Loefflers bought their house with. Circa 1945, Life also seemed to operate under an assumption of endless open space connected by endless open freeways. The wrongs of the past are so easy to identify that it can be hard to appreciate the pieces that feel right. What feels right about the story isn't the style of the houses or the size of their respective yards, but that it defines affluence in terms of breadth. It's a picture that can't be reproduced today, when the California housing story is about a growing market for homes that cost $30 million and up, Silicon Valley software engineers who consider a $400,000 annual salary middle class, and teachers who get up at 4 a.m. to drive to work and along the way past tent cities under freeways.